In 1974's American Graffiti, my all-time favorite movie, by the way, greaser John Milner snaps the Beach Boys off from the radio and wistfully states,
"Been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died."
Now, for the record, the Beach Boys are among my favorite bands, but Milner's sentiment, set 3 years after Holly's tragic death, is still worth considering. Personally, I would have countered John Milner by saying that rock and roll fragmented after Holly's death, but that doesn't fit into a movie script very well. Anyway, Buddy Holly and the Crickets contributed significantly to the evolution of rock and roll, especially in the realm of creating a rock and roll band rather than just one figure on stage. This makes for one incredibly large fragment, as so many legendary groups, from the Beatles to the Hollies to the Rolling Stones, and yes, Mr. Milner, even the Beach Boys followed the pattern created by the Crickets. My guest in this episode, Gary Clevenger, researches Buddy Holly and has written a pair of books about the Lubbock, Texas musician and his group. We cross paths on a Ramones Facebook page, which is appropriate considering they too are one of a seemingly endless supply of rock and roll groups that extend from the direct line that Holly and the Crickets created. I want to get right back into what we were talking about before I hit record.
Well, thank you for having me as your guest.
So you were saying that Buddy Holly and the Crickets, you know, there might be some exceptions to the rule, but as far as being the most easy to point to group to sing, they were the ones who started the rock and roll quartet template.
Yes, that's true. Matter of fact, in one of the documentaries that I own, Paul McCartney is quoted as saying that if it wasn't for the Crickets, there wouldn't have been the Beatles. So,
and I remember it, even like, wasn't it Keith Richards and Mick Jagger met because of their shared love of Buddy Holly, and they were like share records and stuff with each
yes,
other.
Exactly, they share records,
and you know that was like their. And so you've written a couple books about Buddy Holly, right? Words of Love and.
Well, there's actually two books. The first one is Words of Love, 1959 to 2009. The other book is called Six Decades of Rock and Roll Memories of the Crickets. So it's like, you know, the Crickets, as far as I'm concerned, are the longest surviving group that's out there. You know, they lasted for over 60 years until, like I said, their bassist, Joe B. Malden, had passed away several years ago. And now the drummer Joe B. Malden, J.I. Allison passed away. And but before that, matter of fact, I was actually privy to going to see one of their last concerts, which was in 2012. So and you know, you think from 1955 to 2012, that's a pretty good stretch of time.
Yeah, I'd say that's a good run. How did they sound in 2012? Did they kind of keep the same, you know, as good as they could, the sound of the Crickets?
They actually sounded very, very good. I was surprised that, the theater wasn't filled out. There must have been maybe about 20 or 30 people there, but they were just as tight as any band could that you could ever imagine. You know, mm-hmm. Like I said, I've been to concerts where there's 100,000 people and, you know, there's something about a small venue and a small band on stage that I think is every bit as impressive as the big venues with a lot of people.
Yeah. And that's kind of like the, you know, I was thinking recently, so the last weekend, not this weekend, but last weekend was the memorial of the day the music died. So that's, you know, when Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and J.P. Richardson, and of course, their pilot. They always overlook the pilot. I mean, the poor guy. He died too. But they passed away in early February of 1959, while on tour during the winter dance party tour. And the Crickets were not part of that, correct? So the Crickets were Buddy Holly had disbanded the Crickets. Is that correct?
Well, they didn't really disband the Crickets. So what had happened is Buddy Holly wanted to move to New York with his wife, Maria Elena, and because he wanted to be a little bit closer to the publishing business and the music business in New York. So J.I. was invited and Joe B. was invited, and make a long story short, they decided not to go. And they said, well, you go and we're going to stay here. And so while in New York, Buddy had the chance to do the winter dance party. And, at that point in his career, his career was kind of waning a little bit, if you'd like to say that. So he decided to go on the winter dance party tour, but he didn't have a band because J.I. and Joe B. decided to stay back in Texas. So he got Waylon Jennings, which was a good friend of his, and Carl Bunch and Tommy Alsup were the crickets for the winter dance party tour.
So was he able to say these are the crickets, or was it just Buddy Holly and three other guys?
Well, he was able to say it was Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and
Because when I look at their tour, that particular tour, and just to kind of go back to what you're saying about different venues for rock and roll, you can get the giant, I kind of wonder sometimes if Buddy Holly would be impressed or discouraged if he saw, Motley Crue in a giant arena. He's like, this is, what I started. But a lot of those places that they were playing in 1959 were like ballrooms and armories and like the traditional, the traditional places, especially in the Midwest, where, for the better part of a century, that's where the community would hold its functions and stuff. It wasn't like, it didn't take long after that, like throughout the 60s and 70s, definitely the 70s, that you start to see like bars and clubs that are dedicated specifically to rock music. And so like Buddy Holly, and Ritchie Valens and the rest were touring, each place probably had, it was almost like, those old major league ballparks. Like each one had its own little, aspects of it where their sound probably came out a little bit different because of the shapes of the walls and, how old the place was and how many, the kind of, how many people could fit and stuff like that. So it's almost like, those early stages of rock and roll, when rock and roll was still getting its identity, it was still trying to find its place in pop culture. Like, where are we going to perform? What are we going, what's our crowd going to be? When we look at Buddy Holly, how early, how close to like the foundation of rock and roll would you put Buddy Holly himself? Is he like super early, like, Sun Records early, or is he a little bit beyond that?
Well, I think that it was probably definitely be before Sun Records because, like I said, Buddy Holly was he actually got interested in playing music when he was very young. He had two brothers, older brothers, one named Larry, one named Travis, and they were going to perform for a talent show in Lubbock. But his brothers, they thought, well, that Buddy was going to get up on stage and he was going to not help their performance. So as a joke, they gave him a little fiddle, but on the fiddle they put oil. So when he would put the bow across the strings, it wouldn't make any noise. So make a long story short, everybody just was so happy to see this cute little kid up on stage playing the fiddle that they actually won the contest that night. And it was a $5 contest, so they won $5.
Nice. And it was, and it began, I guess you could say that was.
And it began. And then, through that, Buddy got older and he progressed. And, as he got to learning to play, everybody, they picture Buddy Holly, they think, oh my God, just. The only thing he could play is probably an electric guitar. But no, Buddy played the banjo, Buddy played the mandolin, Buddy played acoustic guitar. And when he was first starting out, he said that he wanted to have a guitar like his brother. So he asked his other brother for money to get a guitar like his other brother, and his older brother, Larry, is the one who bought him his first guitar.
So he was in a musical family. He had that surrounding his life, and you know, his sound. I think the sound that he produced as, you know, as an adult or a young adult, and you know, that they're very iconic. You know, I always think of like Raven or Oh Boy, that, yeah, that really like crisp, you know, it's, you can see, you can hear, I should say, like the country twang in it slightly,
right?
But the driving drums and everything is that is the foundation of rock and roll. That is in Lubbock. Where's he getting that kind of sound, or did he invent it himself?
Well, Sonny Curtis tells the story that you know, Buddy Holly would come over to his house late at night, and they would sit in their car that belonged to the Curtis family, and they would listen to a show out of Shreveport, Louisiana called Stan's Record Rack. And on that show, they played like all the old early blues stuff like Lead Belly and Howlin' Wolf and things like that. So that's where their music kind of picked up a little bit of that influence. And also another thing that really helped Buddy in the early days was that Elvis Presley came to Lubbock.
Okay.
So when Elvis came to Lubbock, you know, he wasn't even a star at that point. Matter of fact, they talk about hanging out with Elvis, and they went to go see a movie with him. But the minute they saw Elvis and they saw what he was able to do on stage, they said, that's what we want to do. So, you know, at that time, you know, there were songs like That's All Right, Mama. And, you know, some people may say, ooh, that's a rock and roll song, that's a country song. But the good thing about a song like that is they were able to play it on a country station and get away with it, even if it had that rock and roll beat to it. So, and like I said, after that, that's just after Elvis came, Buddy pretty much went out, and then it just took off from there.
So, and this is pre Ed Sullivan Elvis, but it's Elvis, you know, after recording some stuff in Memphis, and he has, you know, a little bit of a reputation, I guess. I mean, so what it sounds like to me is this is more of a case study of just the power of radio, that he could be taking in a station all the way from Shreveport. And I mean, I know that, like, that's also one of the origin places of like ska music in the Caribbean, out of Jamaica, is a lot of the people in Jamaica were listening to the stations that they could get from the mainland on their transistors, and they were incorporating their traditional sounds from the island with the sounds of pop music in America. And that's where we get that kind of thing. And it's so amazing how music, like, once radio shows up and is applied for, you know, entertainment purposes, just how it opens up so many worlds. You know, I was just actually talking to somebody recently, because I'm up here in New Hampshire, and that's where Aerosmith got its start. And not because, you know, they met at some rock club in New Hampshire, not at all. They were all just guys from New York City who were vacationing up in the Lakes region here in the state. And they, you know, in the summertime, you know, met each other, and, you know, just like some of those other groups that we've talked about, you know, found that they liked the same kind of music, and they're being influenced by not necessarily live music, but what they're hearing on the radio and what's on the record, and then seeing what they could do with that as a group. And then, of course, they went down to Boston to actually perform, but it was, you know, just the radio had so much influence over everything, is what it comes down to. But going back to Buddy Holly and his Elvis connection, I, you know, a couple summers ago, I've mentioned it so many times on my podcast, but a couple summers ago, I took a drive from New England to the Grand Canyon and back again. And on the way out, we stopped in Cleveland, which Cleveland has the claim. And the reason why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is there is like, well, you know, we're here because of Alan Freed, and Alan Freed coined the term rock and roll on his Moondog show. And it even says that he has he's a wonderful, I don't know if you've seen his grave in Lakeview Cemetery in Cleveland, but has on the back of his headstone, which looks like a jukebox, it has the explanation of rock and roll. It explains how rock and roll transcended race. It transcended class. It was like the perfect music. And then it, on the other side of it, it explains that he coined rock and roll. Well, then on the way back a few weeks later, we stop by in Memphis and we go to Sun Studios, and the gentleman there who gave a fantastic tour, including, you know, showing us that that song Rocket 88 mm-hmm. was the original distorted guitar because of an accident where Ike Turner dropped his amp out of the back of his truck and they had to repair it. And anyway, when they bring you into the actual studio itself and they show you the spot where Elvis recorded, you know, his first record, and Johnny Cash was there, and, you know, the Million Dollar Quartet, they claim that they say it, this is where rock and roll was born. Mm-hmm. And so I told them, I said, on the way out, I'm like, you know, I heard that in Cleveland too. You know, rock and roll was born in Cleveland. Rock and roll was born in Memphis. Rock and roll, honestly, we could say it was born in Lubbock. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a time, I guess, where it's just like all of these different kinds of sounds are just kind of bleeding over into each other and mashing up. And so the sound that Buddy leaves with from Lubbock when he decides to stake out is, would you say that's a good combination of all of his influences, blues, country, bebop?
I would most definitely say so. I was also going to mention something earlier. You know, Buddy was always an idea man. Somebody could tell him, hey, why don't we try this on this record? And he'd say, okay, let's try it. Or if he got an idea, he'd say, I think we're going to do this instead. Let's try it. So that was one nice thing. And like I said before, the one nice thing about Buddy is recording at the Norman Petty Studio, which was 90 miles from Lubbock, that Norman didn't charge by the hour. He charged by the session. So if, so if the session took 2 hours, that was it. If it took 2 weeks, that was it. But kind of prior to that, I meant to say something and I didn't. But prior to the Buddy seeing Elvis, him and his good friend Jack Neal were asked to perform every Sunday on a show out at KDAV Studios, which was primarily they played gospel and they played country. But Buddy and Jack were they were asked if they wanted to have their own show out there for, and they called it the Sunday Party. So you know, they did, and they played songs out there on the radio, and they've actually found a couple of acetates that they did not know existed probably about 5 years ago.
Whoa.
Which had from one of the Buddy and Jack shows, and it was his friend Jack Neal playing singing vocals, and no vocals from Buddy Holly on those acetates, but he was playing guitar. But then after Buddy and Jack kind of went to the side, then we have Buddy and Bob, Buddy and Bob Montgomery. And so then, you know, they went out and did their shows and things like that. But then kind of fast forwarding a little bit, then after that transition and the seeing Elvis perform, then that was the catalyst for Buddy's career taking a jump start.
Yeah, it really seems like in that era, you know, and we overlooked gospel. I mean, that's an important one too. That there was so many, there was only like, you know, country, gospel, rhythm and blues, It's like there was too many different variations of music to just contain in those different categories. You know, that there's just like so many going on, because every single time somebody like a Buddy Holly or other artists or an Elvis Presley here, you know, comes in one ear and then, you know, they do something with it in their mind or they do it with their own talents and they project it out. Just like that, we get something brand new. And after, you can only go so far by labeling everything, okay, that's country, but this is country also, and that's country, mm-hmm. before suddenly you're like, okay, we just need a new name for this thing. You know, we just need to call it something new. In his lifetime, he was called a rock and roll artist eventually, right? Like he broke free from just being rhythm and blues,
right?
Or country. What which record of his would you say was like the quintessential Buddy Holly and the Crickets? Like this is when he has made his own sound. Is there a particular record that you would say is like that's the one that is the iconic Buddy Holly?
I would say it's going to be That'll Be the Day. Actually, it was the first song that Buddy had ever written, and he wrote it with his friend J.I. Allison. They had been to go see, excuse me, they had been, they went to the movies to go see the John Wayne movie, The Searchers. And throughout that movie, John Wayne kept saying, "That'll be the day, that'll be the day." Huh. They're walking out of the movie theater, and Buddy looked at J.I. and he says, "You know what? I think I'm going to write a song." And J.I. said, "That'll be the day." And Buddy goes, "That's a good idea." So they went back to J.I.'s house, and believe it or not, J.I. Allison had his drum kit in his room and a piano. And that's just between the two of them, about a half hour it took them, and they had pretty much finished That'll Be the Day.
That's incredible. And I love hearing stories like that about different media forms crossing over without even intending to. I'm sure when whoever wrote The Searchers, the movie screenplay, was like adding that in there, never thinking that it would jump off of their page, right, off the screen into the lap of a musician who then turns out one of his most iconic songs. Yeah, that's incredible. I love stuff like that. You know, I just want to backtrack for just a minute. What is your connection to Buddy Holly? What is what got, you know, because I would label you an expert on him. Where did that begin and why?
Well, it actually began when I was about 12 years old. I was spending my summer vacation at my aunt and uncle's house in Riverdale, Michigan. And, you know, you're a young kid. You think you're going to spend some time with your relatives, and it's going to be a couple of weeks. And you think, hey, this is going to be great. But you don't ever think that you're going to get bored. So, you know, one day I woke up, I was a little bit bored, and I asked my aunt for something to do. And she says, well, why don't you go in and watch some television? Well, that was back in the days, just to kind of show you how old I am, remembering when a TV and the record player were all in one unit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I couldn't find anything on TV, so she had a bunch of old records laying around, and it was the Everly Brothers and, oh, let me think, Bobby V and Sam Cooke. And then I came across the album, The Buddy Holly Story. And if you look at that album cover, it's just got a close-up of Buddy Holly, and I thought, this is a very intriguing cover. I wonder what the inside sounds like. So I put the record on the turntable, and I put the needle down. And from the minute I heard the first words come out and the music come out, I said, this has got to be something special. And I listened to the whole thing, flipped it over, listened to the side two. And then I listened to it a couple more times. And from that point on, I was kind of stuck.
That's awesome. That album cover and just his appearance does not give a hint of the sounds that you're about to hear.
Right.
You know, the big thick rimmed glasses, you know, very straight laced look to him, but he was a maverick. I mean, he was really, you know, kind of a wild, I guess, you know, what we would call 20 years after he was around, you know, punk. Like he was doing, you know, making sounds that were not usual for the time, you know, that he was making some really good stuff that, you know, years later we're like, whoa, like this came from the 50s. Like this came from this guy, you know, how did he, I would say that my connection to Buddy probably stems from, you know, just kind of hearing it on the radio throughout most of my life. My mom has a story because her name is Margaret, but she goes by Peggy. She has, you know, I remember her telling me because she was, you know, she grew up in the 50s. She was a little kid in the 50s, and about some neighbor boy in her apartment building in Mount Vernon, New York, who would play the record Peggy Sue, you know, out his window for her so that she could hear it. Like his little, you know, communication to her. And so she always liked that song. So when that song would come on the oldies channel or something, she would turn it up and say, oh, this, you know, tell that story. And it was like, I would hear them kind of disparately around, you know, all the, you know, just here and there in movies and in the background, stuff like that. But it wasn't really until I got into the 70s punk stuff, like the Ramones, that I fell in love with their style of just 2 minute long songs, verse, chorus, you know, just the same format, and kind of gang, at least half the band, you know, kind of gangly, goofy looking guys, you know, not overly, you know, like studs or anything like that. And like very approachable, you know, very like, oh yeah, like they're one of us basically. And it was through them that I started to kind of backtrack everything. I'd be like, okay, you know, they're covering a song by The Searchers, which I'm assuming that group, you know, Needles and Pins, I'm assuming they named their band after the John Wayne movie. And then like, okay, they're also covering, you know, like whoever they covered, I would kind of give that a listen. And while they never covered a Buddy Holly song, which would have been fantastic, you could still hear that kind of music. So when I go back to the 50s, you know, and listen to Buddy Holly or Chuck Berry or, you know, all those artists from that era, I'm like, yeah, this is the same story. It's not, they're not disconnected. They're not like, you know, and so it's like I just kind of fell, like the Ramones made me fall in love with rock and roll.
Right.
You know, not just the punk stuff. It was like, I just fell in love with rock and roll. And so as such, you got to know your fathers of rock and roll. And Buddy Holly's one of those fathers.
Right. You know, and it's kind of interesting, you know, Joey Ramone, you know, he is quoted as saying that punk is not really a music style. It's an attitude.
Yeah.
So, believe it or not, one of the songs that the Ramones performed was basically their answer to one of their favorite songs that was on the radio. I think it was, boy, I can't even think exactly when it was a big hit, but the song by the Bay City Rollers, Saturday Night.
Oh, Saturday,
they considered that a punk song because they had never heard it before. It was different and it was new. So when their song Blitzkrieg Bop is supposed to be their take on a song like Saturday Night by the Bay City Rollers.
Yeah. And it's like all those British bands, like the Bay City Rollers being, you know, Scottish and everything, like their take on rock and roll was so based on it was wonderful, like back and forth across the Atlantic that took place after World War II, where like those skiffle artists of the late 40s and 50s in England were taking the blues music from the American South that they were having imported to them on records, you know, and on the radio and stuff. And they're singing about stuff, you know, it's English guys singing about being on the Delta or, you know, like very American things and, you know, the Rock Island Line or something like that. And then they end up inspiring, you know, artists who then send it back to America. And then back in America, rock and roll really starts to come out. And then we send that back to England, you know, with like Eddie Cochran you know, starts to spread through England. And then they take the Beatles and the, you know, the whole British invasion comes back to us in the 60s. It's this like wonderful back and forth that just kept going back, you know, throughout I saw America in concert this summer. And I knew this about them anyway, because I'm an Air Force brat. And they were Air Force brats, like the core members of America grew up. They were teenagers on an Air Force base near London. And they said it was fantastic because they were at ground zero. This is like 1969. They're there for the Stones. They're there for, you know, Jeff Beck. They're there for, you know, all those like artists that were already taking off or about to take off. They got to see them like in little clubs and coffee bars and stuff like that. And then because of their status being on the American airbase, they were getting records from the States earlier, like months earlier than their English friends off the base. So they became like the magnets for all the kids who are like, oh, we want to hear the, you know, whatever the latest American release was, sometimes of British bands, but they got it early because it's American record companies. And I'm like, that can only happen because of World War II. If it wasn't for the Second World War, no reason to have American air bases or army, anything like that in Europe, and having that like steady, constant presence of American culture right there. Or if it had been like the previous war, we would have just come home, you know, but because of the Cold War and everything afterwards. So it's like, you know, just the something as simple as the Beatles loving Buddy Holly and the Crickets so much, their format, their sound, their appearance, and saying, oh, cricket, that's funny because it's like the sport, but also the cricket.
Right.
We could do, let's change the Beatles, you know, instead of just Beatle, like it's traditionally spelled, it will be, we'll spell it different just as like a, you know, a little nod to them. I'm like, and then they go on to becoming like another one of those pantheon of rock and rollers that we all have to say, yes, the Beatles, you know, are one of the best. So I just went on a ramble there, but I think
that's fine. You know, but just speaking of things that connect one to the other, you know, it made me think of, and I'm sure you've probably seen it 100 times, but the movie with Marlon Brando, The Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
And the fight scene with Lee Marvin. And he calls
the Silver Beatles, right?
You know, he just calls everybody. He says, you bunch of Beatles.
That's right.
So, I mean, so it was out there in pulp culture even before the Beatles came up with the name.
It's incredible. And it's just like, there's just so much in that mid-20th century, to pull from. I mean, I think about the Misfits. I mean, the horror punk group from New Jersey that they get their name from Clark Gable's last movie, you know, and they, like so many of their song titles and songs are, you know, sometimes the songs have nothing to do with the title of it, but they pull from just like all the movie titles from the 60s or the 50s, you know, just like B-horror movies and stuff. And it's just like, it's like a treasure trove of, you know, material to work with. Like, you know, you could go on all day about it. Now, when Buddy Holly, how close to reality would you say the 1978 movie with Gary Busey, how close is that to fact when it comes to the Buddy Holly story?
That there's very few facts that actually, the only thing I can say really good about the movie is that it brought attention to Buddy Holly, and it brought new fans to his music. But as far as the facts on things like that, you know, like in the movie, his parents didn't approve of him being a musician. In the movie, in reality, his mom and dad were his biggest supporters. Also in the movie, there are no mountains in Lubbock, so. and lots of other things too. I mean, there was
Hollywood movie magic, right?
In the movie, they had his girlfriend. Her name was Peggy Sue, but you know, in reality, his girlfriend at that time, her name was Echo McGuire. So, and Peggy Sue was the song actually started out as Cindy Lou. Buddy wanted to write a song with a girl's name, but then he's going to write this song for his niece, Cindy Lou. But Jerry, at that point, had started dating Peggy Sue, and he was trying to con Buddy into changing into Peggy Sue because he wanted to impress his new his new girlfriend. So, make a long story short, they finally ended up changing it to Peggy Sue. But like I said, the only thing good about the movie is it did bring a lot of new fans to his music. Kind of skipping over a little bit, I will say another thing about Buddy Holly, which was another connection to Buddy Holly and the Ramones. Buddy Holly and the Crickets really did much better overseas. Mm. Like the Ramones did much better overseas than they did here in their own country. So, you know, that's just another interesting fact.
And I'm glad, and I think that relates to so much about, like, you know, when we're ready for stuff, you know, when America, you know, it's like we generate plenty of culture, you know, musicians and things of our own, but it's like the general public, the actual popular culture is maybe not always ready for it, for whatever reason. Funny because like when just before and then definitely right after both Joey and Dee Dee died in 2002 or that and Waylon Jennings died right around that same time, there was like finally an acceptance of the Ramones in pop culture. Like there was, you know, t-shirts and, you know, you could buy them at regular stores and you hear their songs on commercials. And I just heard Blitzkrieg Bop on a commercial the other day. They found their way outside of, you know, baseball stadiums and stuff, you know, jock jams. They found themselves on, you know, more of a pop culture radar. And I feel like the same kind of thing that 20-year layover took place with Buddy Holly too, where it's like, you know, he died in 1959. So, you know, obviously he couldn't make more music after that. Yeah. And the movie comes out 1978. So like the year before the 20th memorial of his death, and it's like a highly romanticized version of Buddy Holly. It's, you know, and the reason I was asking is because like I know that the last scene is obviously very fictionalized, you know, the way that all of the guys get on stage at the same time and do a big, you know, we're gonna die tomorrow kind of, you know, send off, you know, where, you know, it's like in heaven kind of thing. But the rest of it, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it is truthful, but it's definitely coming from the 70s more than it is the 50s. It's like, right, you know, the people of 1978, if they were teenagers when Buddy Holly was actually on the radio and was performing, they were approaching middle age in 1978. So it's like, it's 100% a nostalgia piece. It's just like, hey, do you remember, you know, and we're seeing, and then like, 10 years after that, that's when La Bamba comes out with, you know, it's kind of funny. It's like Ritchie Valens, maybe just because he was so much younger, had to wait another decade before his. And I remember, like, I was alive for that one. I remember, like, kids in the playground singing La Bamba as if it was a new song. You know, Los Lobos did the cover version of it for the movie, but the kids were singing it as if it just came out. And I'm like, you know, when I finally got older and watched the movie, and in retrospect, I'm like, oh, that song was like 30 years old by the time we were singing it. But, you know, thanks to movies, once again, the crossover works. They help each other. You know, it really promoted both. So Buddy Holly appeared on television a few times, right? More than a few times in his career. How much would you say, how much of a role did TV have in his popularity and just early rock and roll in general?
I would say that it played a little bit. You know, it was always important to have your songs played on the radio. It was important to let, you know, the viewing public know that your presence was there. On American Bandstand or Ed Sullivan, you know, there was always that, hey, I made it to the Ed Sullivan Show. We've made it. So, you know, that's important. Oh, to keep your name out in the forefront, because like they say, you know, if you don't, you know, keep your name out there and keep making records and keep touring and doing whatever it does to keep your name out there, whatever it may be, you're going to be forgotten. So, and then they're going to go on to the next thing. So, you know, without getting into really in-depth topic about it, you know, there were a lot of artists that were on like the Dick Clark Show, and, you know, they were happy to get the exposure. They kind of thought maybe they were going to maybe get a little bit more than the exposure without going into too in-depth on this. But the only thing they ended up pretty much walking away with was exposure.
Yeah. So, and that's, I guess, really all they could ask for. You know, if anything, maybe it just allowed for fans to put a face to a sound. You know, they hear it on the radio. And, I mean, definitely for Elvis, it helped him because he was a very good-looking guy. So, you know, him on TV gyrating around was, like, part of his, you know, rise, like rapid rise to iconic status, you know, king of rock and roll. Buddy kind of had that geeky look to him. So I'm wondering if that, you know, didn't really make much of a difference. It's almost like his music probably was its stronger suit. It's like that, you know, they always say, you know, like that 1960 debate between Nixon and Kennedy, like, oh, those who heard on the radio thought Nixon won, and those who saw it on TV, and, you know, with Kennedy like winking at them and stuff, and, you know, handsome president to be, you know, said Kennedy won. I don't know how much truth is to that, but it's like, I don't think it's a coincidence that television and rock and roll were on the rise at the same time. Like, if those sounds had started to come out in the 30s, you know, if rock and roll, it's a funny image thinking of rock and roll in the 30s, but if rock and roll had started in the 30s, it may have just been a fad had it not, you know, because TV hadn't arrived yet. And I'm just wondering if there's like some kind of, you know, just kind of feeding into that post-war teenage culture that, you know, television, rock and roll, you know, drive-ins, all that kind of business all rolled into one. I don't know. But so you're saying Buddy didn't get nearly as much out of television as he was hoping for.
No. I think he got out of television what he needed, but it helped move him along. But, you know, it's like kind of going away from Buddy Holly for a few minutes and kind of talking about the Ramones. It's kind of like the same pit that the Ramones fell into. You know, the Ramones, you know, granted, Buddy Holly was getting airplay and being on these television shows was helping him. But like the Ramones, they weren't getting a lot of airplay. So to keep the momentum going, they were having to do concert after concert after concert after concert after concert just to keep the ball rolling. You know, and I somehow sit here and think to myself sometimes, they could have had it much easier if, like, a lot of the radio stations of the day would have played their songs, you know, and then they wouldn't have had to have been out touring all the time. You know, just it kind of give them a little bit of a break, but that didn't happen. So then, unfortunately, like you said, after the Ramones, each one of them started passing away, then it became fashionable to start playing them on the radio and, you know, and you know, a lot of these people at the radio stations didn't think it was any big deal and why they didn't play him to begin with, probably, but just a little bit too late now that they've all passed away, you know.
It's a shame, actually, because it's like both of these groups that we're talking about, Buddy Holly and the Crickets and the Ramones, are definitely products of their time and place. You know, like I was fortunate enough at the very first episode of this season of my podcast talked to Monty Melnick for the show, and you know, of course, he being their tour manager was like on the front lines of Ramones at the, and you know, I asked him, I said, you know, I said they're ultimate New York music, like there's I don't think they could have, like, that sound wouldn't have come from anywhere else but New York. Like when I think of New York, I think of when I want to hear New York, just listen to Johnny Ramone's, you know, buzzsaw guitar. That's New York. It's like fast, loud, you know, modern. It's, you know, metallic sounding.
I hope you've enjoyed our conversation so far. Please head over to patreon.com/EPS podcast to hear the remaining section of my conversation with Gary about Buddy Holly and the Crickets, as well as the Ramones. You can also hear it as a paid subscriber over on Substack at epspodcast.substack.com. There you'll also find show notes as well as essays written about history and pop culture and history, and everything else. Until then, I hope you've enjoyed listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including Buddy Holly and the Crickets, are primary sources.